22,000 jobs last month, down from 79,000 in July, and the unemployment rate ticked up 4.3%, according to the Labor Department. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you are tuned into WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice.
Escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in occupied Washington, in Distrito Colombia, here on this Friday, September 5th, 2025. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show, and of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we spend the hour with freelance writer Francisco Lozano to discuss his firsthand experience on the effects of the U.S. economic embargo on Cuba. And he joins us on the show for the first time. Welcome to the show, Francisco Lozano.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So before we begin, I need to give a shout out to our friend of the show, Arturo Dominguez, who's a frequent guest here on the Latino Media Collective, for connecting me to you and on this important story. There's a lot to discuss here. So let's begin, actually, by explaining what challenges you face just getting to travel to the island, because one would assume, or at least I would assume, that during this current Trump administration, it has become even harder and harder to travel to the island. So Sure. Give us your explanation as to how you made it to Cuba.
Yeah. So this was my fourth trip to Cuba. I fell in love with Cuba growing up in the war-torn El Salvador with my older uncles. I grew up hearing about Che Guevara and the revolution in Cuba. But anyway, having said that, it's my fourth time. It has become a little easier for me to navigate through the red tape. Americans, and I hold a U.S. passport, cannot travel to Cuba as a tourist. But one of the things that you can go through the red tape or you're allowed is that if you're a journalist then you can travel. So you have to sign an affidavit with a travel agency when you apply for a visa, and then you state that you're a journalist. You can also go if you're part of a church or any humanitarian aid. And those are the reasons that Americans, or if you have family in Cuba, then you can travel being a U.S. citizen. Mind you, that is not the Cuban government that sets those restrictions. The Cuban government welcomes you.
Yes.
But it's rather the U.S. government, as part of the embargo, that does not allow that in order for you not to go and spend your dollars in Cuba. So right before I left, it's when Trump announced that if anybody was doing tourism if any American was doing tourism in Cuba, they could be fined up $250,000 or something like that. That got me a little bit nervous. But no, I went and came back without the fine. So, yeah.
Well, thankfully, you didn't get the fine. But as you just mentioned, there are quite a lot of challenges just to travel to Cuba, among other things. So in the heart of your article, and I forgot to mention this at the beginning of the show, is that you have an article in the Antagonist magazine, which Arturo Dominguez presented to me. It's entitled, "Hear from Cubans on the Island About Life Under the Embargo." So with that said, can you tell us about sort of the power outages that you faced firsthand when you arrived in Cuba and how it has become sort of the new normal for the island? There are a lot of things with regards to the Cuban embargo that we could hit upon, but power outages, as I said before, is sort of becoming the new normal. So let's begin there and explain how frequent these things have become under the U.S. embargo.
Definitely. First of all, I want to thank Arturo also. This is a collaborative project that we did. I reached out to him, and knowing that he's a really good writer, he does a lot of research, and I wanted him to do that part. So it's a combined effort. Los apagones, the power outages, have become such an issue in Cuba. People are really, really unhappy, to say the least. It creates a lot of stress. Just 3 days ago, one of my contacts from Cuba had told me that they were without power, and this woman had anxiety, had stress. She told me, "Me quiero cagar en todo." And just that's how bad she felt because of the stress. And it used to be that in Havana, they didn't have power outages. It was mainly in provinces outside the tourist area. But now they have become a new normal, as you said, even in Havana, where it used to not happen. The day that I arrived, the power went out three times at the airport. Now, they did have a plant and some lights came on, but the computer systems were not working. So we had to wait to check in, to get into the country. So I remember that one person during the power outages at the airport yelled, "Bienvenidos a Cuba." Welcome to Cuba. And everybody applauded, meaning, yeah, we know this is what it's like. Yeah, we're in Cuba now. No power. But it's going beyond frustration. The economic impact after COVID got really people exasperated. But incredibly, the power outages is really what's killing the people right now. It's so stressful there in Matanzas, which is where Varadero is, a really popular beach. However, Varadero doesn't happen often, but Matanzas, in the city of Matanzas, they go without power for about 3-4 days at a time, continuously. And people, I mean, it's so stressful. I could almost say that it's almost the effect of sleep deprivation. People don't sleep. People get stressed out. They lose whatever food they have in the refrigerator because of the power outages, and food being so scarce and expensive, it aggravates not only do they not have power to cool their house or whatever during the hottest month of the year, which is August, but losing their food losing connection to the internet, it creates a lot of chaos for the people. And there's a lot of protests that go on in these small towns that we don't usually know about except for social media. So social media is playing a big role too. I think Miami, the U.S. per se, is using social media to exasperate the situation, make it look worse, seem worse, and also accentuating how bad things really are. So people get worked up even more.
So save that thought on the issue of social media. We'll get upon that later during the course of the conversation. But we can hear from your own observation that a lot of the Cubans are very aware, very cognizant that a lot of these problems stem from the U.S. unilateral, and you underlined this several times in your article, unilateral economic embargo on Cuba. Now, with that said, though, during the course of your article, during the course of your trip, a taxi driver actually told you the following, quote, "We have two kinds of blockades, the one from the U.S. and the one from our government," end quote. And by our government, the driver is talking about the Cuban government. Can you elaborate on what that means? Because obviously here, during the course of this conversation and many other publications that have looked at this embargo, the large responsibility ultimately lies on the U.S. But you point out that amongst the Cuban public, there has to be some responsibility from the local government as well, correct?
Correct. That's actually a very popular common thought in Cuba by the Cuban people, is that they no longer believe or blame the embargo or el bloqueo, as they know it, as the root of all the problems. There's a lot of discontent against the government, the Cuban government, that people tell me that, several people have told me the same thing, that they have two embargoes. One is the embargo from the U.S., and one is the one imposed or created by the Cuban government. Because people feel that a lot of the issues may not directly be connected to the embargo, or they stop believing that the issues are related to the embargo, and that is a lot of the government neglect. There's a lot of discontent against the current president. People mention that they miss Fidel, that there's a lack of leadership. And so when people don't have food, they don't have medicine, when people don't have a good paying job, and the apagones, the power outages, people blame it solely on the Cuban government. So there's this thing that's boiling, and it's been cooking. And lately, well, some of the Cuban ministers have acknowledged that they have dropped the ball, or they haven't really addressed the issues. And I think that's a good step, because they really need to step it up. They feel that there's no leadership, that Fidel was always up front, and they don't feel that that's the case with this president.
And this is quite important, because we have to like tiptoe sometimes with criticism of the Cuban government, because as you just said, that yes, the Cuban government has some responsibility that they need to account for. And you point that out justifiably in your article. At the same time, you don't necessarily want to give ammunition to right-wingers here in the U.S., whether they're Cuban or otherwise, to say, hey, this is why we're imposing this embargo on Cuba. So there's a fine line that not everyone is good at threading here, but I think you did a good job in your article. I'm curious to know, sort of as an example of public discontent with the government at the moment, as it pertains to these power outages and some other issues, you point out the Cuban Ministry of Labor, Marta Elena Feito Cabrera, and some comments that got her in a bit of trouble. Can you expand upon this? Because I think this is an example of what you just mentioned earlier.
Right. So the Cuban Congress, if you will, was addressing the issue of homelessness in Cuba, which I didn't see the first time I traveled there, which was 2020, right before the pandemic. And so she had said that people were faking being homeless, that people were dressing as homeless, but they were not really homeless people. And that the president criticized her and said that that was not acceptable. And she ended up resigning. So that was, you know, a denial that not even the president denies, which is a good thing. It is the reality, because now you can see people begging or asking for money in Havana, which I didn't see in 2020. Kids that asking for a dollar or whatever, or candy. The elderly also that asking for hands out. That was not seen in 2020 before the pandemic. Now it's a common sight. People going through piles of trash looking for something, whether to eat or to use. That was not seen before. And that's another issue that people are really unhappy about is the trash collection being neglected, where you can see piles of trash in corners of Havana. Havana was a really clean city when I first visited.
And see, once again, I have to underline this, is that we have to walk a fine line in pointing out these justifiable criticisms of the Cuban government without exonerating U.S. responsibility
right.
in creating a lot of the conditions that you're describing here. It's an interesting combination that we have to put those two together. But as you know, in U.S. corporate media, they'll tend to lean on putting most of the emphasis, most of the blame, and not looking at the effects of U.S. economic sanctions, not only on Cuba, but in other countries as well. We just did a show here on the Latino Media Collective a couple of weeks ago on how U.S. sanctions worldwide can kill.
Right.
And that's certainly the case with regards to Cuba as it pertains to access to medicines, which is something that you also point out during the course of your article. Now going to the issue of social media, how does social media fit in your article for those who may not know? I've spoken to Arturo in the past of right-wing radio in the state of Florida, for example, and how it has reached to a certain degree Cuba and all this sort of right-wing propaganda with outlets like Radio Martí, among others. I think Arturo wrote whole articles about these things. But on the island itself, how does social media fit in your story here?
Yeah, big time. You know, we both know that social media, it's a double-edged sword. It can be used for good and it can be used for evil. Cubans are very into social media. They don't really access TikTok for some reason, but definitely Facebook and Instagram. And people get all these feeds and it fuels the anxiety. Now, I want to make sure that I always believed that the U.S. embargo was put in place, just as it's mentioned in the article, to impoverish the island so that people can grow in discontent against the Cuban government to the point that maybe one day they'll overthrow it. That's the real reason why the embargo was set in place. So now, social media, whether it is by news outlet from the U.S., whether it is special interest from the U.S., Miami, that create these accounts, they're focusing on just how bad things are without mentioning the embargo. I believe that probably 95% of the issues are directly related to the embargo. That's the reason why the embargo was set in place to begin with. Only now, the effect of the embargo is, quote unquote, kind of working for what it was meant to be. And that is for the people to be really unhappy with what is going on, the lack of medicine, the lack of food, jobs, the power outages, and through social media, this keeps being put in people's face every day. and it creates that anxiety and that sense of uneasiness and unhappy, you know, sense of unhappiness against the government. That's exactly what the embargo was meant to do. It's an evil thing that was meant to make people miserable so that they may turn against the government. I think the Cuban government has done the right thing by acknowledging some neglect. I don't know how they can get help from around the world to ease the situation. I know that things never went back to the way before the pandemic. So the pandemic was kind of like one of the last nails in the coffin, per se, because things never rebounded. Tourism dropped. In the resorts at the beach, there's still a lot of tourism, but even the resorts get affected by the power outages. I know a person that works in a popular resort where mainly people from Russia and Italy visit. They didn't have power one day, and the toilets were backed up. There was no running water. So imagine, those tourists will probably never come back.
Yeah, this is one component that we can't really predict, which is the long-term effects of this current incarnation of the U.S. economic sanction, the U.S. economic embargo on Cuba. I have to point out that a couple of weeks ago, we had economist Silvio Rendon from the Center for Economic and Policy Research on the show explaining how economic sanctions, mostly from the U.S., actually kill more people than war does. But because economic warfare...
Right. I read that.
Yes, but because economic warfare is not considered warfare in the same way as what we saw in the 80s, for example, it doesn't get the same headlines.
It's not a war crime.
Exactly. It's something that can be done behind closed doors, with secret handshakes, and without public knowledge or input by the general public.
Right.
Now, it's good that we point out this history, because a lot of what you describe in your article is the everyday struggle of Cuban life. But at the same time, the U.S. State Department has placed Cuba on the state sponsor of terror lists. I want to know if you could recognize the contradiction or the juxtaposition of the narrative of Cuba as woefully impoverished. Oh, they're all so poor over there. Yet also at the same time, they're considered a threat to U.S. national security. And I have to say, before you answer that, is that other countries like Nicaragua and Venezuela are also on these state sponsor of terror lists, which also goes to show you how politicized this list is in the first place. And I will say this, just to pull back the curtain here, I am Salvadoran, but I also have family in Nicaragua. The idea that Nicaragua is a threat to anyone, let alone the United States, is absolutely absurd. And I think we can make the same argument about Cuba and other countries on that list as well.
Absolutely. It is ridiculous. We all know that that's just political. You know, if one thing that those countries, all those countries that you mentioned, have in common is that they're socialist country. They're countries that have told the U.S. off. Told them, you know, F off, and they don't align, they don't follow what the U.S. wants them to do. And so by being put in that list, you know, it's just another sanction that has many, many impacts. I have to say this, Cuba is one of the safest countries I have ever visited. The first time I went, I was a little bit nervous because of all the things that we are fed by the right wing in the U.S., that there is no freedom, that Cuba is a dangerous place. I found myself walking at midnight with two cameras, expensive cameras, in neighborhoods that were not a tourist area. And I felt so safe. People smoking cigars at midnight on the doorstep and just saying buenas noches, and I'm walking with two cameras when I felt safe. And I too have visited El Salvador. El Salvador to me is a very dangerous country. Even now, Now you fear the police in El Salvador, not the gangs anymore. I was almost arrested 3 times in El Salvador during the last presidential elections.
Really?
But so Cuba is a very safe country. You don't see it militarized. You hardly see police patrolling. You hardly see police cars. To me, like I said, one of the safest countries. So when you see that, and even the Cuban people call Americans los malos, the bad guys. They call us the bad guys. But they say, but we welcome the bad guys here and we treat them well. And that is true. That is the reality. So it's ridiculous that a country like that will be on a terrorist list. I love Cuba. I love the idea of the revolution, the way it happened. Things need to change, yes, because of the challenge that they're facing now, even more so. I think the Cuban government needs to wake up a little bit for the benefit of the people, and maybe rethink or start doing something.
Yes, and I should point out that this fantasy of Cuba being a state sponsor of terror, it's almost similar to describing Washington as out of control with crime, which is what this current administration has done in the last couple of weeks, to say the least. This is why I'm referring to Washington as Occupy Washington right now.
And that is the reason why I came to D.C. this week, because of what Trump is doing and the way he's labeling Washington. You know, I'm from L.A., and L.A. can be rough. And I'm here in Washington, and I was in a well-off neighborhood. I was at the wharf, and there were DA agents. There was like a group of like 5-7 DA agents patrolling on foot. And so I approached them with my camera and said, "Hey, what are you here for?" And they didn't want to answer me. I insisted and said, "What are you here for?" And they said, "Safety." I said, "Safety? I feel very safe here. This is a tourist area. There's no danger here. You know, it's a show. It's a waste of time." And they just walked away. And so that's exactly what it is. I was at the Union Station the day that the vice president showed up. And again, they had extra military vehicles. The National Guard are not armed because they're not supposed to. But if it's so dangerous, why would they be patrolling without any weapons? You know, it's because there's no need. It's a show. Yeah, exactly. We're in such a dangerous city that we're going to patrol without weapons. Okay. Not even batons during. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. During the LA protest, the National Guard had riot gears on, and they also had batons. But they're empty-handed. They just sitting there. It's pathetic. It's really pathetic. How can he sell this? It's beyond, but we all know that. And yeah, that's the reason we came. I said, I don't see action. I came looking for action. I haven't seen any action.
Well, I'll tell you what, whether it be Los Angeles, Washington, or Cuba, the political perception does not fit reality here. So we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Francisco Lozano, who's a freelance writer. His recent article in the Antagonist magazine is entitled "Hear from Cubans on the Island About Life Under the Embargo." This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Occupied Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Lucifer, son of the morning, I'm gonna chase you out of earth. I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase Satan out of earth. I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase the devil out of earth. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race.
Satan is a evilous man, but him can't choke sit on I man. So when I check him, my last in hand, and if him slip a gun with him hand, I'm gonna put on a iron shirt and chase Satan out of earth. I'm gonna put on a iron shirt and chase the devil out of earth. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. Oh yeah. Iron shirt and chase Satan out of earth. I'm gonna put on an iron shirt and chase the devil out of earth. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. I'm gonna send him to outer space to find another race. Satan is an evilous man, but him can't choke sit on I man. So when I check him, my last in hand, and if him slip a gun with him hand, I'm gonna put on a iron shirt and chase Satan out of earth. I'm gonna put on a iron shirt and chase the devil out of earth. I'm
gonna say that was Max Romeo, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Occupied Washington. Reminding everyone that you also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez. And today on the show, we're spending the hour with freelance writer Francisco Lozano, whose recent article is entitled "Hear from Cubans on the Island About Life Under the U.S. Embargo," which is on the Antagonist magazine. So going back to your article, Francisco, I want to know if you could tell us who is Lester Mallory in your article. And I think this is very important because, you know what, we haven't really mentioned the Trump administration during the course of this conversation. And that's because mainly when it comes to Cuba, what he is doing as it pertains to this U.S. embargo on Cuba is neither new nor original. And not only that, but we also have to point out that this embargo, this hostility towards Cuba for so many years crosses both the Democratic and Republican line. And it really makes no difference which party is in power, because the statements from people like Lester Mallory make it clear that it doesn't make any difference which political party is in power, so long as they continue to push this line against Cuba.
Definitely. And sadly, a lot of the sanctions that Trump imposed during his first administration were kept in place by Biden. So you're right. It doesn't really matter. That was something that I was very critical of Biden. Why did he keep those policies in place? But yes, well, this person was a diplomat. He was the Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs. Mallory was, when I was reading his memorandum, you can see the evil intention. And this is a memorandum that he sent to Eisenhower, which is the one that started the embargo on the U.S. And in his memorandum, he clearly outlines that the only way to alienate the people against the Cuban government is to create poverty and misery on the people of Cuba, a war crime, if you will, we both know, with the intention that the people will turn against the government. When I first read this, I mean, it only made clear what I always thought. This is an evil thing that they impose so that people will be so unhappy and upset with what they're going through that they will blame the government. Now, it didn't have that effect on when Castro was in power, when Fidel was in power, because of the leadership that he had, because of people believed in him, because he was always up front, finding a solution, talking to people, addressing the issues. And that's one of the things that I always admire about Cuba, that a country that could survive for 60 years with an embargo, and how creative and how resilient the people and the people believed in the revolution, the people believed in Fidel, that it didn't have that effect. The embargo didn't work for 60 years. At least it didn't have the effect that this diplomat intended when he wrote the memorandum to Eisenhower. But sadly, we're seeing it now. We're seeing it now post-pandemic. We're seeing it now because things have worsened economically and the power outages. It can probably seem like a light thing, but definitely it's creating a big effect on people. Like I said, it's almost like a sleep deprivation. When there's no power, people stress out, they don't sleep, and they're angry the next day. And so this was just an evil thing that this man thought of. I don't even want to even mention his name, but it was clearly with the evil intention, the only way to overpower Castro or to bring down the revolution is to make people miserable in the island. And now I have begun to see it in the last 2 years, how it's having that effect. And that's why I think that the Cuban government needs to be more proactive and get more support from around the world. I know that most of the world is against the embargo, but they're suffering. They're suffering. People have free access to doctors. They go to the dentist, whatever, they go, they have surgery, whatever, no charge at all. But they get sent home with a prescription because the hospital doesn't have the medications and the people don't have the money to buy the medication. So that's a really, really hurtful situation for the people.
Knowing what we know now, and actually I think people have a better understanding today than they did back then on how U.S. economic sanctions can kill more than war does, to look at what Lester Mallory wrote on a piece of paper on this memo, actually reading it in your article, some of the quotes that he mentioned, it almost sounds like a premeditation to murder.
Right.
Knowing what we know about U.S. economic sanctions. But again, like we said earlier, economic warfare is not considered warfare in the same way that would shock the senses if we were to see it visually. It's done behind closed doors. And because it's done with a magic wand and just a sleight of hand, that it doesn't get the headlines that I think it deserves. It's hard to explain, but it deserves our attention, especially when you hear something like this. It sounds to me, at least, like premeditated murder. Now, the irony on top of everything else when it comes to putting Cuba on the state sponsor of terrorism list is that they've actually been the victim of more state-sponsored terrorism than the United States has with regards to this particular relationship between U.S. and Cuba. I mean, mentioning Arturo Dominguez again, I think he's written a lot more about this with regards to things like Operation Mongoose, the Bay of Pigs, the Cubana Airlines Flight 455 that killed 73 people. I mean, the list goes on and on. Can you explain a little bit more or tell us a little bit more about this component of your article for those who may not know?
Yeah, definitely. I think, like you said, the irony, because the embargo, you and I know, and we can see it as a form of terrorism, is terrorizing the people of Cuba. So for the U.S. to put Cuba in a terrorist list when the U.S. is the one that's doing terrorism on Cuba, because we cannot call it anything less. When when the evil of that memorandum was to create misery for the people, and as you had mentioned, that it kills people, then that itself is terrorism to me. So that irony is beyond any explanation. And once again, Cuba is one of the safest places I have visited. I will continue to visit for as long as I can. And it just doesn't make any sense. It's just an excuse. They're the victims of terrorism. Cuba is very peaceful. The people are very peaceful. Like I said, I never saw the military in the island. I never saw a police officer, maybe a couple of vehicles. People now that they speak up, they're unafraid. They're not under threat where they can say, well, if I speak out, they're going to jail me. That's not the sentiment of the people. So if it's not a terrorist state, or if it was a terrorist state, then people would not be speaking out. They would not be speaking out.
Correct. And just to go off on a little tangent here with regards to how unmilitarized Cuba is, we compare it here in Washington. We mentioned El Salvador earlier. I mean, you want to talk about a militarized country in El Salvador. I mean,
right.
You could be in the capital city or in one of the smallest towns in El Salvador. And if you go to an American establishment like a McDonald's or a Starbucks or something like that, you will see an armed guard with a shotgun or an AR-15. And that's just a small microcosm of how militarized El Salvador is.
Right.
But they don't get the same distinction as Cuba does right now because of this current cozy relationship that the Trump administration has with the Bukele administration. But I digress here. So as a journalist, Francisco, do you see in any way, shape, or form sort of the tide turning or perceptions changing by a younger generation of people when it comes to Cuba and this embargo? Because in your article, you mentioned Belly of the Beast, which I would encourage everyone to check out. It's a fantastic media outlet that has done a lot of work and breaking down not just the U.S. embargo on Cuba, but the history of U.S. relations, not to mention the hypocrisy of U.S. foreign policy on Cuba. This was not mentioned in your article, but I'm curious to know that with outlets like Belly of the Beast, which to a certain degree has gained a greater audience, do you feel the tide is turning at least with younger people? Because the days of Orlando Bosch and Luis Posada Carriles from this Cuban exile community who were really dangerous and who were real terrorists, is the tide turning in that direction? Is there some degree of optimism here?
Yeah, I think unfortunately the tide is not turning on the favor of Cuba in that sense. The Belly of the Beast, I met with one of their reporters in Havana. So I had a long conversation about the issues and how things are going and how they also know that social media is playing a big role on the uneasiness of the people. The one thing I'm noticing regarding with younger generation is that they have lost the perception or the idealist of the revolution. And that's something that is not in favor of Cuba because the younger generation are disconnected, they're disenfranchised with the revolution. They're not like people that are in their 60s or 50s, that they believed the ideals of the revolution. The younger generation, they're buying into social media. They want freedom. They want the U.S. They want the Nike sneakers and the Calvin Klein t-shirts and so on. So they're bought into that. So I see it turning, but not in the favor of the people of Cuba. The younger generation are disconnected with the ideals of the revolution, and they're buying more into the commercialization of everything that we have in the U.S. that makes us happy. So, yeah, sadly, yeah, that's the case. That's what I can see in the younger generation. I don't think people in the island follow things like Belly on the Beast. I think the Belly of the Beast is followed mainly in the U.S. It's a good source.
Yeah.
But I don't see them reaching out to the actual people in Cuba.
Yeah, I'll say this about Belly of the Beast, that if they're not turning the tide, organizations like them are not turning the tide and raising a greater degree of awareness with regards to U.S. hypocrisy on economic embargoes like that of Cuba, at the very least, they are doing a greater service by educating and enlightening the general public that does listen to them and does look into their work. And I would say the same thing about your article as well, in pointing out the realities, whether they're convenient or inconvenient in Cuba, with regards to the everyday lives of ordinary people. So we have about 5 minutes left. And I just want to point out that we are going to create a link to your article on our Twitter account so people can learn more about your travel, your recent travels to Cuba, because there's some other things that we probably didn't mention during this course of conversation that perhaps we should probably mention right now. So in the few minutes that we have left, are there other intangible things that you noticed in Cuba that caught your attention that you probably didn't put in your article? And what else do you hope people learn from your recent travels over there as well?
I think from my travels, from my writing, from my documentation on through photography, I want people to be aware of the evil of the embargo, why it was set in place, and the effect that now is doing that was intended 60 years ago, that it didn't work for 60 years, but somehow now it's working, if you will, to an extent. I think the people, well, tangible or not, even from 2 years ago, the last time I went before this was 2 years ago, people were not so outspoken about the issues as they are now. Even one of the tour guides on a bus gave a political note to tourists about the crisis in Cuba. So one thing is clear, that people are unafraid now to speak. And that's a good thing, that the people are speaking out. They're speaking out and speaking up. But now it's time for the government to listen and take heed, as I said in the article. It's for their benefit. It's for the benefit of the people that they listen to these intangible things and the tangible ones to try to bring out a difference, to make a difference. The people of Cuba deserve it. The people of Cuba have been terrorized for 60 years with this embargo.
Yes, and we mentioned earlier that there's a fine line that we have to draw in doing stories like these. And one thing I would say in this conversation is that the goal here is not to convince anyone to like or love the Cuban government, but rather to respect Cuban people, Cuban society, because history has shown us that economic embargoes like these do not affect the government per se, but rather the people, the public.
Right.
It's 2025, and this foreign policy has not been changed since the late 50s. And it should also be pointed out, and I stress this all the time, that it makes no difference which political party is in power here in the U.S. U.S. foreign policy, U.S. hypocrisy towards Cuba has remained unchanged. And so with that said, we've been speaking with freelance writer Francisco Lozano. His recent article in the Antagonist magazine is entitled "Hear from Cubans on the Island About Life Under the Embargo." And like I said before, we're going to create a link to this article on our Twitter account. But in the meantime, it's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you very much for being on the show with us, Francisco Lozano.
Thank you for having me, and keep up the good work of bringing light to what commercial media wouldn't dare to speak about, and also Arturo and the like. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. And shout out again to freelance writer Arturo Dominguez for helping us out with this conversation. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone again that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
Are you ready to move, groove, and exercise with the WPFW family? WPFW's annual 5K Run Walk for Total Fitness happens Saturday, September 13th from 8 a.m. till 1 p.m. This fundraiser will be held at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland. In addition to a scenic 5K trail, fitness and wellness classes will be offered. Lively music to fuel your participation in the activities, along with water and healthy snacks, will be provided. Details are at WPFWFM.org or call 202-888-5484. There's something for everyone to enjoy. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome to the Collision. The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
WPFW presents Genius plus Soul equals Ray and John. Tuesday, September 23rd, 5 a.m. until midnight. This will be a fundraising birthday tribute like no other. illuminating the lives and contributions of Ray Charles and John Coltrane, two icons of American music. Schedule and details at WPFWFM.org, where you can also contribute anytime. WPFW, preserving the culture, one broadcast at a time.
For WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Today, a new jobs report revealed a massive slowdown in the labor market. WPFW's Noah Portner has more.
Early this morning, the Bureau of Labor Statistics released the latest jobs report, and it's really bad. Only 22,000 jobs were added compared to the expected number of 75,000. This is the first jobs report since President Trump fired the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor Statistics over a month ago. The president fired the commissioner after the July jobs report came in significantly less than expected. According to the Bureau, in June, 147,000 jobs were added, in July, 73,000 jobs, and in August, a measly 22,000 jobs. The 22,000 jobs is not enough to sustain the current U.S. immigration rate or birth rate. Donald Trump has reacted by questioning the data and claiming that accurate data will not be available this year. The overall unemployment rate remains very low at 4.3% for now, although according to Axios, this rate has skyrocketed to around 7.5% among black women. From WPFW, I'm Noah Portner.
In more news, the Israeli military destroyed a high-rise in Gaza City today. The strike came shortly after Israel announced it would target tall buildings it identified as being used by Hamas, and as the Israeli military stepped up operations in the territory's largest city. Israel began an offensive in Gaza City on August 10th and now controls about 40% of the famine-stricken city, a military spokesperson said yesterday during a press briefing. Also yesterday, UNICEF's communications manager for the Middle East and North Africa regional office, Tess Ingram, described what she recently witnessed in Gaza City and why she is driven to call on the international community to do everything possible to prevent catastrophe.
It's hard to imagine that in a situation that is already so catastrophic, where almost a million people are seeking refuge after almost 2 years of war in a city that has been under constant bombardment, they're exhausted and they're traumatized, half of them are children. It's hard to imagine in that scenario that things could get worse yet again. And yet here we are. And that is why I believe this is such an important moment for moral clarity and action from the international community to push the parties to the conflict to agree to reinstate the ceasefire. That ceasefire is the best medicine for a famine, and it is the best and only way to protect the scores of children that we have in Gaza City and the rest of the Gaza Strip from being killed and from being injured, as we are seeing every day here at the moment.
And in more news, after destroying a boat in the Caribbean and killing all aboard on Wednesday, the Trump administration continues to deploy warships near Venezuela. Again, here's WPFW's Noah Portner.
The White House caused both diplomatic and domestic alarm on Wednesday when it revealed a video showing a small, fast boat in the Caribbean being destroyed in an explosion. The White House claimed that 11 drug traffickers were killed by the U.S. Navy while trafficking drugs to the U.S. When questioned as to why the 11 people were not arrested and the drugs not recovered, President Trump retorted that the strike was a warning and more would come later.
And there's more where that came from. We have a lot of drugs pouring into our country, coming in for a long time. And we just, these came out of Venezuela.
Eight warships have been deployed to the Caribbean to fight what the White House calls narco-terrorists. the killing of the men aboard has been denounced as a violation of international law, although the U.S. Navy carried out similar actions against Houthis in the Red Sea just months ago. Venezuela has taken the stance that the videos of the incident are AI-generated, attempting to cast